Radio.
Guinness and God presents Leah Darrow, speaking on the topic, How I Discovered I Was Made for Greatness. Guinness and God is brought to you by the Catholic Life Archdiocesan team of the Archdiocese of Canberra and Goulburn and Australian Catholic University.
Thanks. Hello. Hi. How are you all? Doing well, huh? I have been very blessed to... This is my first time in Australia, ever. I love it. I think you all are amazing. You sound fantastic. I was telling my husband as soon as we got off the plane that one of the first things I noticed was your shoes. You have amazing shoes. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's just more of a Euro thing, but I said, Ricky, do you see them? Do you see their shoes? He's like, Leah, they're just shoes. I said, no, they're more than just shoes. I really like shoes. You'll find that out later in a few minutes when I talk and tell you a few stories. I promise, guys, you'll be able to deal with it. It's okay. But I'm very happy to be here. I'm very thankful and blessed to be here, and I'm honored to be here. Honestly, I am. I'm not just saying this. I can't believe when I looked out my hotel window today and I'm looking at your parliament and everything, I'm like, how did I get here? How did this happen? I mean, I was born and raised on a small farm in Oklahoma in the middle of the United States. I grew up Catholic. I was born Catholic, grew up that way. I'm the oldest of six kids. So I've, perfected the art of being bossy and delegating other duties to other people so I can watch them. I'm really good at that. If you're the oldest, you understand my position, right? We're really good at telling people what to do. And at one point in our lives, I'm sure there was this question of like, you could do two things, you could be a CEO of a company or you could be a dictator of a small country. And you're just not sure what you're going to do. But I was raised that way. I was raised in this little small place. And my family, we went to Mass every Sunday. We did the normal Catholic thing. We did have a large devotion to Our Lady. And we said the rosary every night. And that was a beautiful thing. I'm very happy my parents did do that. It taught me how to talk to God. So later in life, when things really fell apart, I at least knew what to do. I knew how to at least speak to God the Father, and I could talk to him and pray to him. And that's kind of what prayer does. It teaches us that language, that dialogue in a way. And so all that goes on. However, as a really young girl, I knew what I wanted to do. Maybe this is it for some of you as well, but like for some people, something hits you, as a youth or something like that, and you just know, I know what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. And this is one of the stories I wanted to share with you, if you don't mind. So I was about nine or 10 years old or so. And I'm in my room, and I don't know what I was doing, listening to music or something like that. And just really, hanging out as a 9 or 10-year-old, whatever we do. And it hit me. It hit me. I knew what I was going to do. And so I had to tell somebody. So I run straight out of my bedroom to my parents' bedroom. I go through the bedroom to the bathroom where I find my mother, and she's cleaning or doing something. And I am, as an intense 9-year-old, mom, you gotta listen to this. And she's all like, okay, Leah. Mom, I know what I'm gonna do. What do you mean? No, I know what I'm gonna do. I know what I'm gonna do in life, Mom. You know that moment when, if you're a parent, you know this, when your kid looks at you and they're like, take me seriously, I've got something to say. And I had the same intensity. My mom says, okay, well, what's going on? I go, Mom, you don't get it. I know what I'm gonna do with my life. And she says, okay, Leah, tell me. Tell me what it is that you're gonna do. And I look at her with the same intensity and I say, I have no idea, but it's gonna be huge. And she just looked at me like, what? I go, yeah, Mom, it's going to be big. It's going to be so big. I have no idea what it's going to do, but it's going to be big, That was a real moment for me in my life. It's the truth. It's what really happened. And I think that all of us, I would venture to say every person on the planet has that moment. Now, maybe you're not as theatrical as I am about it, but I think we all have that moment. We're like, man, I'm going to do something big. I want to do something big. I want to change the world. I want to make it better. I want to do something good for people, right? Nobody wakes up and says, I want to be miserable. And even those people, they want to do misery well, you know? They want to be the best at it. I know it's crazy, but I think there actually are people. But it still holds true. It's still logical to say that we all want to do something big, that we all want to do something amazing and awesome and good, good for the common good, right over the private good. We want to do it. We want to do good, avoid evil. These, in fact, are first principles. And we want that, you know? And I did. I wanted to do something so great. And I knew there was a part of my personality that was just a little bit different. Not special or anything like that, but just sometimes a little bit different. And for me, part of that personality was that I just love to love. I love people. I love loving people. I'm really good at loving people. I see people and I'm like, oh my gosh, how can I love you? You are just amazing. Do you need a hug or a smile or a wave or high five? I don't know, but I'll give it to you. I just want you to be happy. You know, I want you to be happy. And I was always kind of, you know, that girl. I was always really excited, and I always wanted to help people, you know. Anybody drops a book, I'm running, I'm beelining it, you know, to them to pick up their book. And they're like, you are so weird. I'm like, no, here it is. Here's your book. Are you happy now? You know, whatever it is. But I did that. I love, there's a quote from, I believe, St. Francis, and he says that love is not loved enough. I love that. And he's obviously talking about God. God is love. It's an attribute of his. And love is not loved enough. God is not loved enough. I thought that was beautiful. I remember reading that. And I think that speaks a lot to today, to many of us. And for me, I took that personality that I had. I took that desire to love people. And I wanted to go all the way. You know, I knew that that probably was going to be a big chunk in my wanting to do something big, was going to be charity, was going to be loving, and how I was going to love. And so, unfortunately for me, I had this opportunity in my first experience that really defined love for me. And it was different. It was something I really wasn't, I didn't think it would really happen. I didn't think it would really affect me this much. But looking back on it in my life, I realized this is definitely one of those big moments for me. I think we all can do that. We can look back on our life and you can see these moments where things changed. Your thinking changed, your behaviors changed, whether it was better for you or worse for you, but it was that moment. And sometimes these are moments that happen to us. Maybe it's a tragedy, maybe it's a death, whatever it is, but it's a moment. And for me, this was my first moment. I was 15, and I was a sophomore in high school. And in my high school, you know, it was really cool to have a boyfriend. If you didn't have a boyfriend, you had to go to the school nurse because something was wrong with you. Nobody loved you. That type of a weird thing. I'm sure it was only in the States. Anyway, so there it happened, and we have to have the boyfriend. So I get a boyfriend, and I'm a sophomore, okay? I'm dating this guy who's 18. He's a senior, you know, because he can't get a girl his own age, right? So he grabs me, and we're just dating. We're having the best time, and it's fun and everything. And then, of course, that big moment in high school comes up, you know, the big dance, you know? And so we're all getting ready for the dance. And us ladies, we know what it's about, you know? It's the dress, you know? It's not anything else, really. It's the dress. It's your shoes. It's doing your hair, doing your nails, doing your makeup. And it's fun. And it should be. That's okay. We're 15, for goodness sakes. You know, let's enjoy this and just have fun with it. Be a girl. And so I was all excited about it, right? So I'm getting ready for it. And it's just, you know, the week before the dance. And I've got my boyfriend's best friend, who was in my grade, because, you know, that makes the most sense. We were walking out of class, and he asked me a question. He said, Leah, are you ready for it? And I look at him, and I say, you know, oh, yeah, I'm ready for it. And he tilts his head and says, really? I didn't think that you would be okay with that. And I'm offended, highly offended. I mean, I'm a woman, young woman. Why would I not be ready for it? I have my shoes. I have my dress. What more is there, people, to be ready for it? And he just looks at me as I say this, and he's like, No, it. Come on. Are you ready for it? And I think he's got seven heads. You know, I'm like, oh my gosh, you clearly don't hear me. Yeah, I'm ready for it. And I get defensive, and I don't want to, you know, convey to him that I'm not quite sure what we're talking about. So I just say over and over, I am so ready for it. I was like ready like last week for it. All right, so I'm ready. And he's just like, okay, all right. Well, my girlfriends in high school find out that I don't know what it is. They come up to me and they say, okay, come on. You don't know what it is. I once again try to lie and try to act like I do. And I even tried to convince them that they didn't know what it was, and they wanted me to tell them what it was. I know, it's pathetic. And then that kind of, I fell flat on my face there because they were like, really? Really? And I'm like, yeah, okay, I have no idea. I have no idea what we're talking about. I just know it's not shoes, and I know it's not a dress. It could be 7 billion things at this point. I have no clue. And my girlfriend says, Leah, come on, it is sex. Come on, you know that. I didn't. You know, God forbid I be pure and innocent of mine at 15. And it hit me right then and there. Like, we were talking in a whole different language. You know, like, why couldn't he have just walked up to me and say, hey, Leah, are you ready for sex? You know, that would have been so much more clear. It would have been clearer. You know, why couldn't we just talk about that? And I realized today, you know, now why we do that. You see, when things are good, right, and true, when we are proud of them, when we want people to praise us, when we want people to know about all the good things we've done, we shout it to the mountaintops, right? We tell everybody, I did this, I did that, you know, I got this promotion, or I got this on a test, or I got a job, or I'm having a baby, or I'm getting married, or whatever it is. We are excited about it. We want people to know exactly what it is. We spell it out for them in case they don't know. We don't give innuendos. We don't give little words for it. But when we do things that are not good, right, and true, when we do things that are in the shadows or in the darkness, those are the things we end up putting a different name to. We don't want to talk about it. You know, we don't want to say it out loud. And we sure don't want to tell people that we value, that we look up to. We want to especially hide it from them. Because we don't want them to think poorly upon us, but yet we think the act is just fine. Oh yeah, there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with doing this, but I just don't want them to know that I do it. But we still say that act is fine. That's a problem. That's illogical. That doesn't follow. And so to get back to the story, I am once again walking and talking with the same friend, the guy friend, and he says again to me, okay, so I know now that you know what it is, so I need to know, are you ready for it? And I ask him a question. I say, well, what do you think? Which is terrible to ask a, you know, 15-year-old boy. And he says something to me, and once again, I'm not sure if this is going to translate into Australian lingo or not, so I'll explain it if it's not the case. But his response to me was so sad. Really, I pity him for this response. It's terribly sad. And so he says to me, after I ask him, what do you think? He says, Leah, I think it's time that you put the nail in the coffin. Meaning, it's over. It's 6 feet underneath the ground. Finish the deal. Seal it. Bury it. That this act of sex was something relative to death itself. What is that about? How can that be good, right, and true? How can that be something that's not a problem? And I just remember thinking, I remember hearing that. I can still hear those words in my head, and I will never forget them. And I didn't know what to do. I wasn't sure. I was scared to ask my parents. I was scared to talk about those things. We didn't talk about those things. My parents did say, you know, wait till you're married to have sex and all those things like that. But they also told me not to sit too close to the TV and to eat my vegetables. Did the whole no sex thing in the same category as that? I didn't know. See, there were answers to my question, but I was a coward not to go seek them. And that is the worst kind, when truth is out there and we refuse to look at the truth. We refuse to see the truth because what we're scared. We're scared we're going to have to change our life, aren't we? We're scared it's going to affect our life, our relationships, what we do, what we think, maybe even what we dress. And it's difficult. It is difficult. But we shouldn't be cowards to look at truth. At least we should look at the truth, acknowledge it, and then say, okay, I'm not going to agree with it, or I'm not going to go with the truth. You know, that would be better rather than just saying, yeah, it's out there, but I'm just not going to touch it. I don't want to know, you know. I don't want to know what's behind that door. And that was me. I didn't want to know. I kind of knew I shouldn't have. I pretty much did know I shouldn't have. How wrong it was, I wasn't sure. I didn't know exactly what the purpose of it was for. Why do you want to wait? What's the purpose of waiting? What's so big about it? And what's the problem? Are people just hiding this because they don't want us to have fun or not to enjoy something? Or what's going on with that? And all these kind of thoughts kind of came across my mind. I had a group of friends who definitely supported that sex is no big deal. You know, hookups are fine. Casual sex is okay as long as, like, you know, you're in control. Things like that. And so it made it easy to kind of warp myself around these different thoughts and kind of get away from the truth of the matter. And homecoming night came. I was very excited about it. And I got all dressed up in my pretty dress. Ladies, you would have loved it. It was fantastic. Beautiful. This crushed black velvet gown, you know. Don't judge me because it was the 90s and it was cool back then. It was super cool. Okay. And get this. I have to tell you this. It's not a part of the story at all, but I have to tell you. My shoes were amazing. My shoes were made out of the exact same material of my dress, bought at a different store. You know, it is the fashion miracle. You know it. You walk in, you see the shoes on the pedestal, the beam of light comes down, clouds break, voice of God, Leah, these are my beloved shoes. You must buy them. I mean, you hear the angels in the background singing, it's amazing. You got to buy them. I mean, it verges on a sin not to do the will of God. For the fashion shoes. Okay, maybe not, but it kind of feels like that, right? It was amazing. I was so excited about these shoes. I still have them. They're fantastic. And don't really wear them because they're made out of crushed black velvet. So not exactly in so much these days. I'm all excited about it. I'm all dressed up, having the best time. I leave the house. I'm as cute as a button, or at least that's what my mama told me. So I believed her, you know. And I go there. I dance with my boyfriend. I dance with my girlfriends. I had the best time. Honestly, it was so much fun. It was great. Just what dances and parties are supposed to be. It was innocent. It was fun. We were being silly and whatever we do. And it was great. And then, of course, after the dance, you have all those parties that you go to. You go to the one party, and then you leave that party. Then you go to another party, and then you tell the people at that party, the parents at the party, that you're going to be there and you're going to stay there. But then you leave the back part, you know, out through the back door, you go to another party, and you go, you finally find some place where you're all alone and there's no parental supervision. Once again, probably only happens in the States and not here. That's what we do. And we get ourselves in this location where there's nobody around, and, you know, because that's what you need to do the things that are good, right, and true, right? Have nobody know what you're doing. No. And, you know, I had that decision to make. It was here at 15 I had that choice to make. I remember very clearly. Was I going to say yes to authentic love? Was I going to say yes to a sacrificial love, to a love that involves sacrifice and commitment, a love that involves self-control, a love that involves moderation, a love that involves me controlling my passions and of those passions controlling me, where I'm the master and they're the slave? Was I going to say yes to that love? Or was I going to say yes to the imitation of love? Was I going to say yes to the counterfeit? Was I going to say yes to the, okay, it's going to satisfy you and your pleasures for a few minutes, and then in that second afterwards, guess what you feel? Regret, remorse. What did I do? What happened? What was I going to do? Say yes to real love or say yes to imitation love? And I made a choice. I made a choice at 15 that really set my life on a certain path. I was 15 years old, and it did happen. And I said yes to imitation love. And I lost my virginity. And it was that moment for me that everything changed. It's true. Everything changed. How I saw the world, how I saw love, how I saw men, how I saw relationships, how I saw myself, how I saw God and His forgiveness and His mercy. It all changed. Everything started to have a different feel to it, a different way about it. And, you know, it's always this part in my talk where, you know, I always have a hard time looking you in the eye, you know, when I tell that story. And I feel like I just need to say, you know, I'm sorry. And I don't even know you. I just want to say, you know, God, I'm sorry. I should have done the right thing, you know? And I didn't. I still get emotional over it just because, and I believe in God's forgiveness and mercy. Don't get me wrong, I do. I guess I just get more emotional because, God, I did not know how great I was. I did not know how amazing my gift of my virginity was, my gift of self, dignity of the human person. You know, I didn't know that. I didn't get the full grasp of it, and it just irritates me that I didn't, you know? Because we are worth it. We're worth sacrifice. I'm not worth a, oh, baby, I love you so much. Prove it to me. Do something to prove your love. That's not love, you know? Love can't just be a bodily expression. It can't be the only thing. It can't be like the validation of a relationship is what you do with your body. God, that can't be the way. That can't be it. I think it goes against what's written upon our hearts, whether we want to admit it or not, you know? And I had this wrong definition of love. I looked at love in this purely physical way. And I also didn't realize back then that my decisions would affect me in my future. They would affect me years later. Years later, I'd be sitting here in a group of amazing Aussies telling this story. Who ever thought that? You know, I just didn't think that what I did mattered or that it was really going to be that big of a deal. And I kind of thought, well, sex is no big deal. It's just what you do in a relationship and it's fine and you can justify it with so many different reasons. And usually the reasons that you justify it are based on feelings. Feelings. I feel like I'm ready. I feel like I love him. I feel like I love her. I want to show them I love her. And so we opt to the base pleasures rather than the ultimate sacrifice of life-giving love. We opt out for base pleasures and we forget that love is so much more than feelings. I mean, if I'm sure there's a million examples you can think of in your life. If that love was just based on feelings, then relationships would go nowhere fast. Divorce rate would be 100%. So I made this decision. I made it, and it formed how I saw the world, right? And it formed how I saw love and relationships and guys. And once again, after it happened, I just thought, you know, I'm not worth forgiveness. I can't believe I did this. I felt terrible. I definitely had instant feelings of regret and remorse and all those things and depression, all that stuff that goes on. I had my friends telling me, it's no big deal. Like, you're okay. It's all right. You'll feel better tomorrow. You just need to, like, give yourself some time. You know, just next time, don't do it until you're really ready. Well, when is that? You know, I thought I was really ready then. I clearly wasn't. So is there like a guideline, a timeline and into that point? And it really kind of confused me with everything going on. And I thought I was wasted talent. I thought that nobody would love me. I thought that nobody would want to be with me or date me. Or if they did date me, they would expect this exact same behavior, even though I didn't want to do it. And so I thought, well, God might forgive me, but I don't know if he'll really forgive me. I don't think I'm really worth his forgiveness or mercy. And I didn't understand it all. And it just fueled my life. It fueled everything. It opened up the door for anything else. Because if I really wasn't worth the forgiveness or mercy, or if I really wasn't worth real love, or if people looked at me a certain way of, oh, you're that girl who does that thing, then whatever. Why not? Why not, you know, do a million other things? Why not get wasted and forget my name and black out and not even know who I am for a few hours, you know? Why not just go whatever, go on birth control or go to Planned Parenthood for a million different things? Who cares? I'll just get on this because if I'm having random sex, I probably should protect myself and do this or that. You know, why not live this lifestyle? Why not just go into the culture? And I really got involved in it and got involved in everything that was glitzy and glammy. And, you know, they make vice look so attractive, you know, don't they? They make it look glittery and pretty and flashy and fun. And you know, I thought that was interesting and exciting. And so I kind of just entrenched myself in the culture. It really opened the door to just kind of opening up to other things. And I did. And so by the time I audition and I get on America's Next Top Model, I am way far from my faith, way far from anything that I believe. Now, granted, I'm a little warm. I proudly proclaim that I'm Catholic. Oh, yeah. I'm Catholic. I'm so Catholic. which is ridiculous because I have like just I took Catholicism as this great, wonderful buffet meal. And you walk on in and you get your plate and, you know, you put that sacrament on your plate. Yep, I agree with that one. Okay, that commandment, that looks good for me too. No, I don't want that one. I don't want that one. That one confuses my life. That one makes me change things. And I don't want it. And you just put on your plate everything that you want, just what you want. And then you go to the register and check out, and then you get your card carrying member. I'm a Catholic, you know? And sadly, that's what I thought. You know, I just thought, hey, I'm going to pick and choose what I want, and I'm just going to go that way. And you know, unfortunately, that's not the case. And whether you do that too right now or whether you don't, I think we all can at least say that's not what Catholicism is, though. It's not a buffet, it's a banquet where we're asked to sit down for a 7-course meal and asked to be there the whole time, where in fact we actually would want to be. We want to be there the whole time. And you know, and I didn't see it like that. You know, by the time, like I said, I was on Top Model and I was on that show, my life was just one where I justified all my actions with the phrase, I'm a good person. I'm a good person though. Yeah. I know I do that and that, but I'm a good person. I am. I'm good, you know. I use my blinker when I change lanes, and I tip my waitresses, you know. I recycle. That's amazing. I care for the environment, you know. I save the whales. I mean, of course I'm a good person. You know, and that thinking runs down whenever you realize that, like, Hitler woke up every day and thought he was a good person. And then you're thinking, okay, well, if Hitler thinks he's a good person and I think I'm a good person, well, I don't want to, you know, that can't be right, because I clearly don't believe that Hitler was a good person and what he did. So then where's our definition of good? So then what does that mean? How do we base that? Once again, we have to define our terms. You live your life by how you define your terms. How you define happiness, how you define love will navigate how you go in life. Defining your terms will be a major, major vehicle for you in order to get further in life, defining your terms, defining them correctly. I define love as a bodily expression. I define love as like this physical thing. I define love as something that you just have to do, that love involves sex always. And that's just what you have to do all the time. It doesn't matter. Like it has to be a part of it. And if I didn't do that act with a boyfriend, then it meant that I was withholding love. You know, I defined my term poorly. You know, and so by the time I'm on Top Model and everything's going on, I'm all involved in the culture and everything like that. I get there, and I'm sure, as you know, there's nothing real about reality TV. You know, there's nothing real about reality. Okay, you guys aren't really nodding, so I'm not sure if you believe it or not. I see some interaction. Okay, very good. I see a couple people. All right. But there's nothing real about it. They don't give you a script, but they definitely aid you to act in a certain way. Number one, you sign a contract as soon as you get on. It's you have to do everything that they say, or they have the right to sue you for $1 million. We're reminded of that constantly as we go through the show. Every time they see us hesitate on this or that, hey, you signed that contract, $1 million. You signed, you know, and then they'd act like they'd be like sad for us. Yeah, I know you don't want to do it, but gosh, that contract, You're like, who are you? Like the devil? You're terrible. And they would just do that all the time. And that wasn't even the worst thing, okay? It was annoying, but it wasn't the worst thing. The one of the worst things, I thought, was walking in. And the first few weeks or so, we stayed in New York. And we were staying at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. And we walk into the hotel and we get to the bedroom and we notice very quickly that they've taken the doors off of the hinges. There's no doors. Just none. Okay. So then we walk further and we go to the bathroom. There's no doors on the bathroom. They've taken them off of the hinges. We look to the shower curtain and there's no shower curtain. There's nothing. All the cameramen are cameramen. They film you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That wasn't shocking. It is reality TV, okay. And they would film us. They would film us as we're changing our clothes, as we're brushing our teeth, as we use the restroom, as we take a shower, as we do anything. They film you nonstop, just a few feet from you as you're doing all of that. And we would hold up towels, you know, for the other girl in the shower. We would take turns trying to, you know, protect her dignity. Clearly, even we knew that something was wrong. Yes, we might be these crazy models doing all these things, but once again, something's written upon our hearts that says, no, you shouldn't show this. We should have that good element of shame, you know, to protect ourselves, to cover ourselves, and to have dignity. And we would hold up the towels, and I remember holding it up for my girlfriend as she was taking a shower, and I'm yelling at the cameraman saying, why are you doing this? Why are you filming us? You can't do this. You're not going to use it. It's not going to go on the show. And he just didn't say anything, and I just kept berating him, and I just said, stop it. Just stop filming her taking a shower. Leave her alone. And he finally yelled back, because they're not allowed to even talk to you, which makes it even more creepy, you know, or, you know, to have that. And so he says, I have to. They make me. I have to film everything. And I said, well, you're not even going to use it. I know, but we still have to have it. And I just remember thinking, you know, what are they going to do with that footage? What's the point? What's the point of, like, filming us in such insecure ways? You know, what are they going to do with that? And it was very clear, very quickly, that they valued human dignity this much on the show. There's so many stories that I could go into, and I'm not going to really honestly waste your time with too many more, because it's just one after the other. It's the same message at the end of it, of just like, they just really don't care. It's a chess game, and we are pawns, and they are just moving us around so they can make money, and they make it look like it's so great, and they're helping us out, and how wonderful it will be. And of course, we believe that too. That's why we were on the show. We believe that that's what was going to happen. This is going to be a great show. It's going to help our career. It's going to be fun or exciting. And you are on that show. And the moment when you have the most joy is the moment when you're eliminated and you're just out and you're just like left alone. And you know, I was so happy at the moment of my elimination for it to happen. Granted, I did cry and I was a little upset because you think you're going to win and then you realize you're not going to win and whatever. But it was just like, thank God. These people are crazy. You feel like you're in the seventh dimension of hell, you know, like wrapped around you. It's intense about what they're trying to do and what they're trying to put forward. You know, I thought there was nothing wrong with reality TV. Obviously, going into it, I have a different opinion now, being on the other side of the camera and seeing that. And all I can share with you is that how I see reality TV today, of where it's come, and most reality TV, and not all, but I do think most, is that it is very reminiscent of the Roman Colosseum. In the Roman Colosseum, you had people fill that Colosseum. They were there for entertainment. They were there to watch people be eaten by lions, for people to be burned at the stake, a lot of times for their faith, because they were Christians and they weren't going to bow down to the Roman Empire. And you have this going on where people would go in there and they'd sit and they'd cheer for one or the other and they watch people fight to the death. You know, I don't think it's that different when you see not just reality TV, but many elements of our culture today. And we sit back, especially with the media and with the TV and the internet, and we watch people make total fools of themselves. We watch people and we point at them as we, you know, eat our dinner or eat our popcorn, and we point and say, oh my gosh, look at him. He's such an idiot. Look at her. How could she be so stupid? I can't believe they got married. It's never going to last. And we judge them. We have all these judgments upon them and their lives, and we forget, if we dare to call ourselves Christians, we forget that these are our brothers and sisters in Christ, and their lives are falling apart. Granted, they volunteer to be on TV and to do all these things, absolutely, but we're still like, what are we doing, supporting that? What are we doing, you know, watching it and then calling it entertainment? The destruction of lives should never equal entertainment. I shouldn't be your entertainment. You shouldn't be my entertainment. And hands down, if the roles are reversed and a camera crew follows you around every day of your life and they see everything that you do, all of your hopes, all your dreams, the times when you fight, the times when you cry, the times when you're low, the times when you're high, all these different things, and they put it on national TV, you would absolutely revolt over it. You would not want that to happen one bit. Yet we do not question it when we have no problem to watch other people. And we justify it with, well, they chose me on the show. I mean, I'm just watching it. If you complain about TV that you don't like what's going on, all I can tell you is that you have a voice in the matter. Stop watching it. Don't watch it anymore. You see, especially with reality TV, every time that you turn the channel on and you're there for a few seconds, it sends a signal to the network and it lets the network know that you are a viewer. They then use these statistics later on to formulate the standard of if they're going to be able to do another season or not. We had enough viewership during this season. That gives us the power, the money, and everything to do another one, and then it goes on and on and on. Yes, it would take a lot of people saying to not watch it, but that's where it starts, with just a few, and then it goes on and on. So this whole thing with reality TV goes, it was exciting, and it was fun. I'm very thankful that it's over. When I got eliminated, I'm still, like, you know, entrenched in the culture, entrenched in this whole life that I'm in. I'm a good person, you know, it circles around my head over and over. And I decide to live in New York and stay in New York and continue modeling, thinking I'm going to do it. I'm going to make it. I'm going to be it. I had a definition of happiness that involves success and money and beauty and fame. And I wanted it, you know. I wanted people to know me. I wanted people to love me. I wanted to love other people too. Of course, I was loving it in a disordered way, but still, you know, I was trying. And I wanted to have money, and I wanted, you know, all those things. And you know, I got it. For the short time, I got it. I was making $8,000 a day. You don't make it every day. But as a model, I was making that much. My highest paying job was $16,000 a day. I did a couple New York fashion shows during Fashion Week, jobs with just certain designers or companies doing things like that. Got a couple campaigns, and I was making good money. My pictures were on the billboards, they were on, you know, Times Square, they were in the subways, they were on taxi cabs, in magazines, and all those other things. And, okay, so I had all these people making me beautiful. I had all this money. I was getting a little bit more fame, especially with the show. You know, at this point, I should be happy, right? I should be happy. And, you know, it's just sad. I terribly wasn't. I would never admit that. Never admit that I was unhappy to other people, because, you know, we're all in it together and we all have to, you know, be happy. And us models, we are excellent, excellent actors. We really should leave modeling and go into acting, every single one, because we portray and happiness very, very, very well. You know, those pictures of all the models in the magazine where we are in that pose where we're jumping and you know, and we're so happy, right? We got that great smile on our face. Like, we couldn't be happier. And we sell happiness so well. We sell it perfectly. We sell it so well that you will buy something just because we look happy in the picture. And we do. It happens all the time. I mean, I think we all agree. I mean, it's unreal of how much advertising and media influences us with that. You know, a girl, we open up the magazines and we see like this girl on this double spread, right? And it's her whole face. And her blonde hair is pushed back beautifully, right? Her skin is so soft looking. And there's a little, you can see like little tiny hairs. So that validates to you, it's a real woman. You know, it's not just Photoshop. This is real. She's beautiful. And then you all of a sudden you look at her nice, smooth, clear skin, and you go up to her eyes, which is the focus of the advertisement. And her eyelashes have these perfect intervals of space between every single one. And you're thinking, how does she do that? That's amazing. Oh, wait a minute. There it is. Maybelline. And I've been using CoverGirl all these years. I need to go get some Maybelline mascara because that's going to make me look like that, right? Of course. Yeah, no, it doesn't. And here's the other thing. Look back at her skin, for the record. Look at her skin. Ladies, the reason why it's so smooth and so fantastic is because she has no pores. she's dead. Like, she couldn't breathe. You know, that's impossible to be that way. And the sad part is that we forget. We forget plain common sense. We forget the reality. And we buy into their fantasy, right? 100% of women in women's magazines are photoshopped. 100%. Not 95, not 60, 100%. Every picture of a girl that you see in a magazine, something's done to the picture to make her look a little bit better because she wasn't that way before. And so once again, every model is, we know that who we are is not good enough. We take a picture right then and there in the photo shoot. They are telling us, okay, this happened to me. I remember this being in a shoot. I was in this pose, whatever it was. And they're like, okay, take a little bit more fat off her arms, her waist, get her hips too. Straighten her teeth. Make a note to put in more hair. She's got very thin hair. Put in more hair. Take the mole off her cheek and off her neck. Let's get rid of that too. And they're saying this out loud. And they're writing notes. Okay, I will. Okay, I will. And I'm like, what is going on? At least you could talk behind my back, right? This is terrible. And model, you always know you're not good enough. You always know that you're not good enough. And then you create this false sense of wanting to be perfect. You know, you want to be that model that they don't have to Photoshop too much, you know? And so you set this standard that you're never going to attain, never going to attain. Another crazy statistic is that 65% of women in men's magazines meaning like the creepy ones, right, to like the muscle fitness ones, 65% of women in men's magazines are computer generated. They're not real. The women are not real. So you've got these guys who are looking at these magazines, subconsciously saying, okay, this is the idea of a woman. Maybe this is somebody that you like, want to marry, want to be with. I don't know. But you create a standard of a woman looking at these women who are computer generated. And then you're going to go out into the real world and you're going to realize you can't find her. Well, of course you're not going to find her. You'll have a better chance finding her going down the Barbie aisle of a toy store. She doesn't exist. She's not real. And, you know, what does that do for women, right? What does that do for us? It creates a standard for us. We now know, like, wow. And first off, we don't know they're computer generated. We think maybe women do look like this. So what it is, we diet, we exercise, we do all these things to look just right because we have to create a standard of a Barbie doll so that we can fit into it because we want to be attractive because that seems to be what is attracting to the men. So it's this vicious cycle that goes on and on and on. And fortunately, I was aiding in that. I was, you know, modeling in New York, and I was working there after the show, thinking I'm going to do it. I think I'm going to be happy, like I told you before, but I clearly wasn't. And then I get this phone call from an international magazine, and they say, you know, Leah, you have a lot to offer. We think you've got a little bit more, though. We saw you on the show. You're very wholesome, very cute. But we think you have more to offer. And of course, like my ears perked up like, oh, you know, tell me more. Tell me all that I have to offer the world, you know. And they say, yeah, well, you know, why don't we do a shoot that's really sexy? It's really edgy and really kind of, you know, vamp up your portfolio. We'll make it more diverse. You'll be able to get more jobs. You'll obviously be in our magazine, which is international, and you'll be seen all over the world, you know? I thought this was a fantastic opportunity. Absolutely, I wanted to do it. And I said, okay, great, let's go for it. Translation of that conversation between me and the magazine was, hi, Leah, we think you have a lot to offer. Would you like to go to hell with us? Here's a ticket. Come on down. Come on, let's go. And that's really kind of like how, in a sense, how it is. Like, hey, listen, we'd be more than happy to just kind of destroy your life. Would you like us to help you? Yes. Yes, I would. Please help me. Please help me just, you know, lower myself even more. I'd love to do that. Let's lower the bar, right? So that kind of goes on. I get to the shoot and I get into hair and makeup and everything so that I can get ready. And it's pretty normal for it to go on. And in doing that, I am asked to pick out an outfit. So they wheel in a rack of clothes for me to choose. And I see all the clothes here and I'm picking on a couple outfits. But I obviously realized very quickly there's something wrong with the clothing. It's very defective. It's missing fabric. All of the outfits are missing lots and lots of fabric. And I have no idea what's going on. I thought they forgot, parts of it. I just thought, I am not wearing that. There's no way. Granted, my moral compass is so not pointing due north, but I have standards. I'm not wearing that, So they saw my hesitation. They came over and said, hey, you don't have to. We can grab another girl if you don't want it. Just let us know. It shouldn't be a problem, but you just need to let us know quick so we can call somebody else and get you out of here. And I just thought, well, why do I have the problem? If it's ever, if every other girl is okay with it, then I should just be okay with it, And so I kind of took that, unfortunately, and I said, all right, I'm going to do it. It's no big deal. And I remember saying, it'll be over with soon, Leah. Just suck it up and do it. It'll be over with soon. And I think about that today, that I was accepting the consequences of my actions before I even committed the act. Like I was like just saying, all right, this is going to be terrible and you're going to regret it, but it'll be over with soon. And how sad that is that I thought that. But anyway, so I did. I find an outfit, I put it on, and I began to model. And in that time, modeling in that photo shoot, this is the reason why I'm here, this actual part of my story. This is that moment, that St. Paul moment, if you're familiar with that, where he's knocked off his horse. I was standing there, I was modeling, the photographer was taking, picture after picture. This flash came across my eyes, like the flash of the camera, no big deal. I was blinking, kind of turning off to the side, blinking to regain my focus. And in that moment, in doing that, what I'm going to explain to you only lasted a few seconds, less than a minute. Just a few seconds, but I was blinking and I saw this image of myself, like a little movie was playing in my head. And I saw this image of myself and I was wearing the outfit modeling, that I was wearing, this immodest outfit. And I had my hands cupped together at my waist like this. And then I just saw myself raise them all the way up like that. Just like that. Nothing big, just that. I looked out and up and what I did see, the only other thing besides myself, was this profile, this shadowy profile of a man's face. And when my hands were raised all the way up, he looked at them and then bowed his head in disappointment. And then that was it. It was over. It was all done. And this only lasted a few seconds. And I immediately got very scared. I just thought, that's crazy. That's ridiculous. I made it up. That didn't happen. And as soon as my internal voice was saying all these things, it just felt like this piercing in my heart, like this weight that just was convicting me. And it says, this is true. This is your life. Because you see, after that happened in that few seconds, immediately afterwards, I pulled my hands back down and I wanted to see what was so disappointing. And I saw exactly what was in them. They were 100% empty. There was nothing in my hands. And that's what I knew was true. That's what I knew was true. It doesn't matter if people call that a bad ham sandwich or a real good spiritual moment. I knew that was true. I knew that this was a reflection of my life, that I'd wasted my life on myself. I live by the theology of Leah Darrow. I live by just, I want to do what I want to do when I want to do it. And I don't care if it affects you. I don't care if it hurts you. I just don't care. I'm making money. I'm happy. I'm trying to be happy. I didn't care about you here in Australia one bit when I was working. I could care less. I could care less if the images that I did as a model, as a woman, gave bad standards for the women here in this audience of how it made you feel. I don't care. I didn't care how it was for the men to look at that and maybe lust after or whatever it was. Oh, that's your problem. I didn't care. I knew it was true. I knew that what God had given me and my gifts and my talents, I had wasted on myself and my hands were really empty. They really were empty. My life was just that. And by the grace of God, I had courage. I had courage to stand up. The first time I probably had courage in my adult life. And I said, I have to go. I have to leave. And the photographers were, you know, freaking out, like, we're almost done. Come on, let's go. And I said, no, I'm leaving. I take off their clothes. I put on mine. I'm walking out. I have my hand on the doorknob and I'm getting ready to leave. And the photographer says, if you leave, you're going to be a nobody. And I had turned around and I said something to him by the grace of God. I turned and I said, do you promise? Promise me that I'll be a nobody to you. And with all sincerity, I meant it. I had tears in my eyes. I was welling up. And I just said, please, I beg you, please make me nobody. Please don't call me and don't tempt me. Don't offer me another job. I want to be a nobody to you. I want to be a nobody to you and to this world. I've made you everything and you have failed me. And I've made my religion, I have made my faith, I have made my God, I have made Jesus Christ nobody. I've made him nothing. And I want to switch the odds. I want to turn it around. I want the world to be nobody to me, and I want to be nobody to it. And I want to be everything to God, and I want him to be my everything. I did. I didn't know how that was going to look. Once again, like I was 9 years old, I wanted to do something big. What are you going to do, Leah? I have no idea. I wanted to change my life. I wanted God to be at the center of my life. How are you going to do that? I have no idea. But I know it's just going to take one leap of faith. I'm just going to make one action. There are steps 1 through 10, and I can't get to 10 until I take step number 1. I can't start at step 3 or 5. I just need to take one, just one step. And so I did. My first step was just leaving the photo shoot. And I walked out and I was crying and sobbing and going down Fifth Avenue, New York City. I probably looked, you know, like an average New Yorker, you know, and I'm kidding. I love my New Yorkers. But I was walking down, you know, and I finally got to my apartment and, you know, I just left my career. I just left my life. I told off this photographer, you know, and kind of freaked out on him. And what was I going to do? And I did the only thing a girl could do. You know, I called my dad. I called my dad and I just said, Dad, if you don't come and get me, I'm going to lose my soul. And there was a long pause. And my dad responded with, okay, baby, I'm coming to get you. And my father drove 2,000 miles from the middle of the United States all the way to Manhattan. And he came and he picked me up. He gets to the doorstep of my door and I was a mess. You know, I'm just a total and utter mess. And I look at him and he's got the biggest smile on his face that I'd ever seen in my life. You know, like a creepy smile, like, you know, like, oh my gosh, stop, stop, you know. And I open up the door and he's smiling. And the first thing he says is, I am so happy to see you, you know. And I'm like, ugh, stop, you know. It's like, you know, you're sleeping in a dark room and someone throws a curtains back and the sunlight comes in. It's like, ah, you're happy and I'm miserable. Get away from me. I'm sure many of you probably have heard of the parable of the prodigal son. Okay. I'm his twin sister. Okay. Not that nothing's lacking in the gospel. It's just that I'm just 2,000 plus years delayed. But yeah, I'm the prodigal daughter. And so my dad comes up. He's happy to see me. And he's all saying all these things. I'm standing there just like this. Oh, yeah. Like, okay, Dad, you know. And he's just excited and he's happy. And he's like, okay, so what we're going to do. I want to go to Central Park, and because I've never seen it before, you know, before we leave. And then I want to go to Carnegie Deli because I got these big Reuben sandwiches, and I got to get one, you know. And then I want to go to this place called Gray's Papaya. They got these great hot dogs, Leah. We got to get one. We got to get one. And I'm like, okay, I'm just at the point of moral despair, but I guess we'll get a hot dog, and it's gonna make it all okay. And I'm like, okay, whatever. And he says, okay, great, 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 good, good. Perfect. But first we go to confession. Ugh, you know, what was I going to do? I knew I wanted to go. I knew I needed to go. Don't get me wrong. But at the same time, you know, I didn't want to go. You know what I mean? Because when you go, And when, if you're a Catholic, you understand, you know, I mean, we confess our sins to Christ. That sacrament is bestowed upon us through the priest, and that grace is. And but when you admit it out loud to someone, not just to yourself, but to someone else, you know, to Christ himself through the priest, but to Christ himself, that means you really did it. You know, a lot of times we can say things or we can do things and not even say that we did them, but just do them. And we almost accept that, you know, over the statement of the fact. But when you say it, it's real. Your ears hear that you did it. Like, whoa. And that's a big thing. So I'm totally freaked out. And my dad sees that. And he says, okay, you know, I said, Dad, I'm not sure. I might just want to wait till I get home. I don't know. And he very, very quickly corrected me. And he says, Leah, Diane, you called and you said you needed to come home. I'm here to take you home. And church is home. Now, you want to go anywhere else, you can call Southwest Airlines. So, my father has always been a parent where he never threatens his children. He just makes promises. You know, they're promises. They always happen. You know, whatever it is, good or bad, it's a promise. It was a promise if you were going to get in trouble and get spanked, or it was a promise. It wasn't a threat. It happened. Always. You know, as soon as he said it, that was it. There was no going back. So it was a promise that he and my mom made, that before my dad came to get me, that they decided that that's what they were going to do, that that's how they were going to love me the best, was to bring me to the divine physician, to bring me to Christ, to bring me to God, and to reconcile myself with the person that I first needed to reconcile myself with. Because if our relationship with our Creator is disordered, then our relationship with other people, therefore, tends to be disordered in some way. Sometimes it's late on figuring that out. And, you know, so I obviously get to a confessional. That was pretty obvious. I made it there. And I get to this confessional, and I'll tell you this story, not as an example of what you should do, but it's just, it is amusing. So I get to the confessional. I walk in. I know if you're Catholic, you're familiar with the setup. You know, there's the screen. Yeah. And then there's the chair, you know. Saints sit in that chair. Those are some amazing, amazing souls, right? I love that screen. It's beautiful. It's fantastic. Catholic Church is just so smart in so many ways. One of them is the screen. You know, they did a wonderful job with deciding that. So I kneel in front of the screen, and I just say, Father, I don't want to be here. And he says, well, you don't have to. You know, are you Catholic? And I'm offended. I am so Catholic. you know, I'm sure that I feel so bad. I'm sure this priest walked into the confessional just to clean it or something, you know, and then got stuck with me walking in and sitting down and being like, oh man, I had lunch plans, but I guess I gotta sit here, you know, whatever it was. But you gotta, you know, so he's in there and here I am being a brat, you know, and he says, okay, well, what's going on? And then I break down and I really get real with the whole situation, and I'm just getting emotional, and I say, I don't know how to tell you what I've done. And I'm not trying to be dramatic or act like I'm the worst in the world. No, it's terrible. It's terrible what I've done. I am ashamed. I'm scared to even write it down on paper. I'm so embarrassed. I can't even look at myself in the mirror when I think of it. I refuse to see myself in the mirror when I think of my past sins, because, like, I was a good kid. I was a good girl. And how did I get this far away? And so the priest is really hearing my pain, and he said, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to go through the Ten Commandments. We're going to go through everything. I'll help you out. Right now, tell me your biggest sin first. Let's just get that one out of the way. You know, give to Christ your biggest sin. I said, okay, let me just think for a second. He says, okay, take your time. So I'm sitting there, I'm thinking about all my sins, getting in the right order, you know. And, you know, I can see the priest, the little holes in the screen, right? And he, like, comes in really, really close to the screen. And I'm just like, oh, my gosh, you were so close to me. So I pull back, like, And he says, are you still there? You know? And I say, oh, this is terrible. But I lean in and I go, patience is a virtue, Father. And it's terrible. I'm the epitome of vice. And I just told a priest about patience. I can imagine at that point he was just like, you know, pulling out the Exorcist book. Like, what? Who is this? You know? Oh, my gosh. I'm embarrassed to share that. I really am. Because it's, you know, it's a man of God. This is a priest. This is someone who's dedicated his whole life to Christ. And here I am just saying these terrible things to him, you know. And I was just so defensive. I was angry. All this anger is coming out and judgment. And, you know, and I wasn't being judged by the priest. I was being judged by myself. You know, that's really what it was. I was mad. I was mad that I believed the lie. I was mad that I believed the lie in the world of what love was, what beauty was, what success was, what happiness was, what it all was. And it was wrong. And I believed in it. And I just was so mad at myself for it, you know, because I think I was a smart person and I could, you know, do it all. And then you realize, man, you've been had. That's terrible. So anyway, I finally just kind of once again broke down again. I said, you know, okay, Father, I'm sorry. But I think I'm ready. I think I have my biggest sin. He says, okay, go ahead and say it. And I said, here it is. And I gave him my biggest sin. And I could see him, his head nodding and says, okay. He was so patient. He was so loving. And he said, okay, now just say the second biggest sin. And I said, okay, here it is. Boom. That's my second biggest sin. And he leans in closer to the screen one more time, tilts his head a bit. And I'm kind of nervous again what he's going to say. And he leans in and he says, okay, yeah, you really should have said that one first, you know. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this whole process clearly is not working. Father, I'm scared to tell you number three. Where am I going to go from now? I mean, good gracious. And it's hilarious and it is very funny. At the same time, I didn't even know what was worse, you know? I had no idea what sin was worse. It just tells you exactly where my moral compass was, what I was doing, and how I couldn't even get anywhere, really. It was terrible. So, you know, I think he threw out the whole thing of like worst to last and just said, okay, just say anything, you know, just say anything, you know? And so I did. The point is, I gave God everything. I did. For the first time in my life, I did. At this point, I was 10 years away from my faith, 10 years away from the full practice of my faith. I had refused to go to confession for at least 2 years prior to that point. I received the sacrament of the Eucharist in the state of mortal sin because I was embarrassed to keep my butt in the pew. And I thought, well, I had to get up. I had to go receive. It's my right. Ugh, no, it's not my right. It's a gift. And you have to be worthy of the gift. And you have to be in the right state of grace to be worthy of the gift. And I wasn't, but I was embarrassed. So I got up there because, you know, I didn't want people to think poorly of me. Pride of life, you know, just consumed me with that. And, you know, it was a mess. It was even to the point, even at some points in my... When if I did go to confession years before that, I could tell that it was getting bad in terms of pride of life, of wanting even the priest to think well of me or other people to think so well of me. I would be at the confessional. And then sometimes when there was no screen available, you know, I had to sit in the holy chair and I would sit there and I would do this thing. This sounds ridiculous. And it, for the record, it is ridiculous, what I'm about to tell you. It makes no sense, but just shows you how illogical I was. But I would sit in the chair, I'd sit there, and I'd wrap my feet around the back of it because I wanted to hide my shoes. I wanted to hide my shoes. I did not want the priest to see my shoes. And for whatever reason, I thought, well, I could probably like put like my purse in front of me or something, or kind of put my hair around my face so he couldn't see me and see my face. But I wanted to hide my shoes because I thought they were the most identifying piece of material on me. And you know, you have confession and then you have, in most cases, mass right afterwards. And I didn't want to go up to mass and receive communion and the priest be like, body, oh, you're that sinner. No, get back in line. There's no way you did your penance, you know. I mean, it's ridiculous. Once again, guys just don't care about shoes that much, even priests, and it just doesn't matter. But this is how ridiculous the notion I was of just wanting people to think well of me. I mean, it got to the point where it just got bad. But in that confessional, in that moment, I gave God everything. I just said, okay, listen, I truly want to be a better person. As cliche as that sounds, I do. I want to be able to look at myself in the mirror and be proud of who I am. I want to do that great thing. I want to do something great and something big and help people. And I want to do the right thing. And see, we have a choice in the matter. Life is worth living, and it's worth living well. It is. That means it's usually worth living in a very difficult way too, though. Making difficult choices, sacrificing, of course. I was able to walk out of that confessional. You know, I gave God 10 years of my life of pain, of misery, of all these terrible things, you know, and he gives me peace and forgiveness and mercy and compassion. I mean, it's a pretty sweet deal if you ask me. And I walk out, I go home, my father takes me home, and I start that whole rehabilitation of life. You know, one of the things that I did was changing my definition of love. Now I use the definition from St. Thomas Aquinas, which is that love is desiring the greatest good for the beloved. Love is desiring the greatest good for the beloved. So I have to ask you and challenge you, what is your definition of love? You should have one. Love is, and then fill in the blank, what is it? If you don't have it, you need to get one. Because the world gives us a definition, and the funny thing is that they don't love us, and yet they tell us what love is. We must look to those in our life that really have shown us the real definition of love. If you're a Christian, you know, you look to Christ. This is love. You know, Christ spent his entire mission here on earth. He did so many things, his teachings, his miracles, all the things he did to show us his Father's love. And what was the very last thing he did? The very last thing he did was to give us his body. He gave us his life. He gave us the sacrifice of his life. It's interesting, even in today, and I know from my own self, that tends to be the first thing we give someone if we really love them, right? Is our body, and not the last. It seems that the order is just out of order. I took up the virtue of chastity, and I believe in it. And although I lost my virginity at 15, I knew when I came back and when I had my reversion, I was going to take up purity and regain it, that I'm worth a forever love, that I'm worth someone sacrificing for me, that I'm worth waiting for, that I have the capability of self-control and moderation, and I'm not going to succumb to every whim or desire I want to do. That I value men. I value their bodies and their dignity. And I also value them and their whole being. And the fact that I may be dating them and not meant for them. Their wife is maybe a year down the road or even maybe next week if they meet her. And I want to leave that guy in good condition. I want to be able to look at his wife one day and say, hey, I took good care of him. I want that. You know, and I wanted that. I wanted that real love. I wanted to take on chastity. And the funny thing is, people unfortunately think that chastity is just for people who are ages 15 to 25. And that's it. But it's not. Chastity is about saying yes to real love, to authentic love that's sacrificial. And that is really what we need. It's a part of the virtue of temperance, self-moderation, self-control. I took it up, and I did a lot of, God had to really work on me and help me heal from all of my past wounds, from all of my past experiences and the wrong definition of love. But he did. And he continues still to do that. But he has allowed me to experience his love, experience his mercy and his forgiveness and see that every day. And through that, he's allowed me to experience and see that in one man. I was so blessed and I'm so honored to be Ricky's wife. I married him 2 months ago, and it was the most amazing experience that I've ever had in my entire life, is to be able to stand in front of the presence of God Almighty and hear one man vow till death to love me. That's what I'm worth. Yes, I'm worth that type of love, not a baby, I love you. Not, oh, come on, come on. No. I'm more so in saying, no, you are worth my life. You're worth my whole life. I want to give that to you. And that was this beautiful expression. I remember on our very first date between Ricky and I really heard something I think truly inspired from by God the Father through the words of my future husband on our first date. Our first date, I had been, and I think this question that I asked him came out of my defensiveness in all my past relationships. And I said to him after our first date, we had this whole long date, went on a like little kind of picnic thing and went out to lunch and then went by the river and walked around and all these nice little cute things that he did. And he's trying to be cool and everything and smooth and, you know, everything's just right and all that great stuff. And it was great. It was great and all. So it's the end of the date, you know, we're hanging out, we're having a barbecue with some of his friends and he's Mr. Cool, you know, and I finally just asked him, I just look at him right in the eye and I just said, hey, what do you want? And yeah, I know I'm really smooth. I'm just really, I'm very gentle. I'm a gentle soul. And of course he looks at me like, you know, you did not just say that to me, right? And so I say it again, come on, what do you want? And he looks at me, and like I said, I think my question came out of my past wounds, but he looks at me straight in the eye and he says, Leah, do you know what I want? I want to be completely known. I thought about that, and I just thought, I didn't hear him say, he wants my body, he wants sex, or he wants this, or he wants that, or even a hint of any of that. What he wanted was the deepest form of friendship possible. He wanted someone to know him completely. He wanted one person to really sacrifice their life to know him, to know his strengths, his weaknesses, his dreams, know his failures, know everything, and still love him. He wants to be completely known. I remember as soon as he said that, I thought, okay, I think I could marry you. All right. I did. I really thought that. I didn't say it because it would freak him out. You know, you don't say those things. Ladies, any single ladies here, you just don't say that, you know. I know people in the movies do. Yeah, that's just not real life. It'll make him run. He will never call you again after that if you say you're going to marry him after he opens the door for you or something. But anyways, the point is that, you know, I really treasure that moment in my life because I really, like I said, I really felt that was really, really God the Father once again saying to me, Leah, you know, I love you, you know, and I want you to be known and I want you to know someone and know them in the right way, in the ordered way. And that was just a beautiful expression of love that I've been able to recently experience and share. And it was fantastic. I think, you know, John Paul II said that we are unique and we are unrepeatable. We are unique and we are unrepeatable. And so your big thing in life that you want to do, that great thing you want to do to change the world, to help the world, it will be just that. It will be unique and it will be unrepeatable. And if we don't raise the bar and rise to the challenge of this type of a life, then a void will be there and no one else can fill it. No one else can pick up the slack for you. That you are called to be unique and unrepeatable and you are called for greatness. Pope Benedict XVI said that the world promises you comfort, but you are not made for comfort. You are made for greatness. That is fantastic. You were made for greatness. You weren't made just to be down low. So ladies, raise the bar. Gentlemen, raise the bar for yourself. Want something more than just what the world's offering. There's got to be something more than just that. If you want a great person in your life, then be a great person so you can attract that great person because they're not looking lower. They're looking up. They're looking up for that. Lastly, if I could leave you with anything, I'd just love to tell you one thing. And I think it's probably one of the most important things, and that is just one of conversion. Conversion of just turning our gaze every day more and more to Christ, to God, and turning them away from ourselves and our selfish desires. But that conversion is possible. Truth has a face. Truth has a name, and that is Jesus Christ. And you are worth changing for that. Change is possible. Never let anybody tell you you cannot change. Never let anybody tell you, no matter what your age is, no matter what your profession is, no matter what your faith is, I don't care. But don't let anybody tell you that you cannot be better than who you are right now. Amen? Amen. All right, God love you. Thank you for your patience.
That was Leah Darrow with How I Discovered I Was Made for Greatness. Guinness and God is held once a month at King O'Malley's Pub in Canberra. And for more shows, interviews, and talks, visit cradio.org.au.